Welcome to the Shepherd's Crook Podcast. This ministry exists to provide coaching, resources, and events for pastors and church members. My name is Jared Sparks. Join me as I talk pastoral ministry, applied theology like manhood and womanhood, political theology, and cultural analysis with a little bit of hunting and fishing thrown in. I'm a husband, a father, and a pastor, and I'm here to remind you of the chief pastor and our King, Jesus. Hello and welcome back to the Shepherd's Crook Podcast. I hope you guys are having a great day today. I am delighted to have a wonderful conversation today. You're going to get to be introduced here in just a few minutes to my guest. But first, I wanted to remind you of a couple things before we get into our content. I want to remind you of the Sons and Slaves podcast that I have with my boys. We are sons of our Heavenly Father and slaves of King Jesus. And me and my boys are having a wonderful time talking about the book, Boyhood and Beyond. We're going lesson by lesson through things that a boy needs to know as he's growing into manhood. And we're very excited about that content. If you would, please follow the show. I know you've been hearing me talk a lot about it. Also, this is the year that we start our mission quest with Ransom. He's 10, and we start an 8-year process. That's going to be a process through 6 rites of passage. And so we're going to be talking about that on the show. Would love for you to join us over there on that podcast. Also, just a reminder of Jordan, her podcast, Fruitful and Fearless, is going really well. You'll want to check that out as well. Okay. I've been really wanting to have this conversation for a while now because the gentleman I'm talking to is a phenomenal author. I've really enjoyed his works and also his father's works as well. I'm talking to John McClain. John, how you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Jared.
Good. Well, I'm excited for our people that are listening in to get to know you here a little bit more here in just a bit. I'm going to go ahead and pray, and then I'm going to pass it off to you, and we're going to get to know you just a little bit. Let's pray. Father, I just thank you for this time. I ask for blessing upon this conversation. I thank you for John and how encouraged I've been by his works and by the work of his family, and I want to learn everything I can from him. I ask that that would happen even just right now in this short conversation, that we would learn what we can and have a really good time doing it. And it's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen. All right, John, for those that may not know who you are, would you go ahead and just bring us up to speed? Just tell us a little bit about yourself and then your family and then what it is that you do.
Well, my name is John McClain. I'm an author and journalist. I've been working at writing for 60 years. I worked for 30 years for the Chicago Tribune, most of it here in Washington, D.C. as a Washington correspondent. The easy way to encapsulate a career that had many moving parts is to say that I used to fly around the world with Henry Kissinger when I covered the State Department for about a dozen years. I was then the foreign editor of the Tribune for a while and quit when I was 52 years old. I got out ahead of the slaughter of the innocents, which began in the newspaper business about that time. You know, they were throwing people with Pulitzer Prizes out the front door. Wow. Anyway, for the last 30 years, I have been writing books and articles and whatever I can put my fingers to. I've written 7 books, depending on how you want to count them. And the initial ones, initial 5, were about Wildland Fire, which was a subject my father broke the ground on with his book, Young Men on Fire. Subsequent to that, I've written a couple of books about fishing and family, which is also his subject. But so it goes. You have the same genes.
Yeah.
I'm now older than I was, but I'm still finding things to do in the way of journalism and writing. Some can be pretty interesting. I'm trying to put together a story now about the rewards of fly fishing in late life. And I have a lot of friends who are in that position and asking them about their experiences. And it's been a lot of fun to have those conversations.
That's wonderful. One of the things I admire about you and your father is vigor and work ethic into the later stages of life. Now, I don't want to say late stages of life. I'll say later stages, but I really appreciated and admired that work ethic that continues on. I am curious about the transition from your work in Washington, D.C., with the Tribune, and at age 52 is a significant and kind of a scary time to switch careers, especially going into writing books. You don't know how that's going to turn out. And what was that process like for you? Because, I'm 40. A lot of guys are in a stage when they're late 30s, early 40s, where they're middle management or an upper management, but trying to figure out what they want to do for the next 20 to 25 years of actual, work, formal work. But you make this transition at 52. What was that like in that process of moving from one career into kind of a parallel career, but a new career nonetheless?
That was scary. You got that right. I looked around. I've been at the Tribune for 30 years, and I'd run it out. It was time to leave. And my father's book, Young Men and Fire, had come out after it was published posthumously, come out after he died, and I had things to do with that. Initially, the decision that my sister Jean and I made whether to publish it at all. And that may seem like a no-brainer today, but it was not at the time, I'll tell you. There was a real question because he hadn't finished it to his liking. It had an ending, but it was not the book that he would have let go to a publisher had he been in complete command of all his faculties. So, Fire came along in 1994, that was very similar to the one my father had written about, the South Canyon Fire on Storm King Mountain in west central Colorado, killed 14 firefighters. And for the first time since the Mann Gulch Fire in 1949, which was the subject of my father's book, Young Men on Fire, smoke jumpers had been killed on a fire. It was a mixed crew, hot shots. There was a couple of helicopter guys and three smoke choppers. And the topography was eerily similar to Mann Gulch. The fire behavior was similar to Mann Gulch. The initial Associated Press accounts all said, "Oh, this is just like Young Men and Fire." And I had a lot of friends telling me, "You should do a book on this." I was working for the Tribune at the time. And my editor came over to me a couple of days after the fire had killed the people while it was still burning and said, "You should be out there in Colorado." I said, "Honest to God, if I was out there in Colorado right now, what I would do is, pull together stuff that the Associated Press and the Denver Post and Rocky Mountain News have got and put a McLean byline on it." And everybody said, "Oh, well, the son was doing this." And it wouldn't be any different for quite a few days before I could, dig in and find something different. The anniversary of Mann Gulch, 45th anniversary, is coming up this summer on August 5th. And this was July. I said, "Why don't I go to Mann Gulch?" Everybody says it's just like the Mann Gulch fire. Why don't I go see if it is? My father's research partner, Larry Robinson, was still around. I can get him to go and some other people. And we did that. And I went to Mann Gulch and I wrote a story about it. And it was a good story about that place. It's an evocative place. Anyone who walks into Mann Gulch and goes up to where all the events occurred in that bowl gets a feeling from it, a very deep feeling. And I tried to put some of that into the story. The headline writer wrote a headline that said, "Fire on a Mountain." And I really liked that. And I thought, well, I've done my duty. I've done my duty to my father. I've done my duty to the story. I've written something that nobody else could write. About the South Canyon fire, I'm done. And then I kept poking. And I called up the parents of the guy who was in charge of the fire, Don Mackey.
That's right.
He was a smoke jumper in charge. And they lived right at the mouth of Blodgett Canyon in the Bitterroot Valley in Montana. And if you know your McLean literature cold, Blodgett Canyon is a major landscape. And one of my father's stories in A River Runs Through It. So, whoa, wow, getting all kinds of hits here. Guys from Montana, there's a smoke jumper, got Blodgett Canyon. And they wanted to talk. And as I discovered things about him, I discovered two things. One, that he was being blamed for everybody's death. Don Mackey screwed it all up. He made a bad decision and got everybody killed. End of story. And it didn't seem to me that was quite the end of the story. And the other thing that struck me hard was that he had had an opportunity to save himself.
Yeah, right.
And had not done so. And he had gone back to what they call clearing the line to check on people he had put in harm's way. And he had a premonition before that that things were going to go bad. And he had sent his two best friends who were on the line out of there. So you go back and check along the line, see that everything's okay. You know, it wasn't articulated. I don't think he articulated it to himself, but he knew that things were going bad.
Mm-hmm.
He got his friends out of there to safety. He did not get himself out of there to safety.
Yeah.
He was standing at a specific place where he made that choice. And he had sent eight of his colleagues, his small jumper friends, up the ridge to safety. And they made it. Mm-hmm. And they expected him to follow. And then he, instead of following them, went down the line to get the people who were on that line to make sure they got out. And he died with them. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that this was a remarkable act of character. As somebody who would do that, maybe should be looked at a little more carefully than the official accounts were, and that all the easy conclusions right after the fire, it's all his fault.
Yeah.
So that got me into it. And by the next spring, I had quit the Tribune and gotten the book contract and was on my way to do a story about the South Canyon fire.
Yeah. Well, I admire you for that hard call. And you did a fine job. In fact, I have right in front of me Young Men in Fire, and I have Fire on the Mountain right here. And compelling works. And I love that about Don Mackey, because Don Mackey, you get to the end of the book and you realize this is a young man of courage and honor. And to throw him all the blame, I think, is unfair in a wild circumstance of events that came together. And I thought you did a wonderful job telling that story. And I'm sure his family was certainly grateful for that. I think it's an interesting thing. You use the word honor about your father, and well, I've done my duty to my father and to the family if I go out there. And then it developed in, and you kept poking, and the story continued to develop. So your dad does this work, and it's almost like your works are parallel to your father's works, which we'll get to. And if you haven't connected the dots yet, and John has mentioned it, but his father is Norman McLean, and from his work came the movie from 1992, but it was on his work that was released, I believe, in 1976, A River Runs Through It, and other stories, which are also right here. And he first wrote about a family and his love for his brother and his story of the memoir, A River Runs Through the Life of His Story, the story of his life, and writes that book and then goes into Young Men in Fire. Your story seems to pick up from Fire, and then later you get to Fly Fishing and Family and the memoir of love of family. So I'm curious, how did you go about finding your voice? Because it seems like it's not been a tension here of living under the shadow of your father, who started writing later in life, developing his work and continuing it, and then going back into writing about fly fishing with Home Waters. How did you find your own voice? Did you feel almost a pressure there, or was there freedom just to write? And I mean, you'd been doing that for a long time, and just find your own way.
Oh, no pressure. Easiest thing I've ever done. He lied.
Right, I'm sure, yeah.
And well, one of the things I decided when I wrote Fire on the Mountain is that I would not write like my father. I'd been a journalist for 30 years. I had never written a book. I had had to learn how to do that. And it was not an easy process. I had a wonderful editor. I've been gifted to have some great editors who have helped me an awful lot. And he taught me how to write a book. But the style, he kept saying, you know, you ought to open it up a little more. You ought to open it up a little more. I said, no, I'm not going to do that for a couple of reasons. One is this is a different kind of book. I mean, I'm not going back a quarter of a century to mythologize a fire, which is what my father did. I'm dealing with a contemporary event.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to dig out stuff about it that nobody else knows, and take a point of view that is contrary to the common viewpoint on this. And it's going to cause a lot of trouble. And I'm going to do it hard and fast the way I do things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that. And it's a somewhat constricted style. I acknowledge that, but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
It worked for that story. By the time you get to Home Waters, which is much later, 25 years later, I've got a much looser style, much more creative, but it's a different kind of thing. Then you get into the mythology side. Fire on the Mountain was journalism, and deliberately so, to make it look different from Young Men on Fire.
Yeah.
That said, you know, this year is the 75th anniversary of the Mound Gulch Fire, my father's fire. And I'm going to be giving the keynote talk on August 5th in Helena, Montana. So I haven't run away from this thing.
Yeah.
You know, I've been part of it, and I accept that and have worked at it. But I've done it in different ways at different times. And there has been a general evolution over the last 25 years.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. And I think the differences of those two books are come out in your writing style with the Fire on the Mountain book and with Young Men in Fire. One of the interesting things about Young Men in Fire to me is you can see your father's chasing of the story through the entire book. That was one of the thing that was to me what was so interesting is you can feel him reaching and searching through the entire book, and he did find it. But a part of the whole unfolding of that book is him searching and finding the story within the story. And I thought that was really compelling. Yours was a page turner. I couldn't put it down. And it was there was a different flair to it, but it was a very, very fine book and very much enjoyed it. Now, okay, you have developed as 25 years of publishing now, Home Waters. I described it, I don't know if this is a fair way to describe your work, as parallel to your father's. It's not trying to be your father,
fair.
But it does seem to
that
be
is
parallel.
Fair, yeah.
Okay. So what led to transitioning from writing five or six books on fire into writing Home Waters, and why did you write it?
I caught the fish of a lifetime. That's what made the difference. I grew up fishing on the Blackfoot River and, you know, dreaming in the off season about it, and knowing that the big rainbow trout was out there somewhere and never catching it. I would hook it on an occasional summer and lose it. The fishing in those days wasn't like it is now. I went out last fall and fished a couple of days with a group, American Rivers. And we had four fisher guys in two boats on 2 days. And all of us caught at least a 17-inch fish on those days. And the fishing was lousy last year. That wasn't what it was like when I was a kid. The whole summer would go by and we wouldn't see a 16-inch fish. So I was fishing on a hole that is in a river runs through it. It is the only hole that is absolutely identifiable as a locale from a river runs through it. It's called the Muchmore Hole.
Yeah.
And through a whole set of odd circumstances, a friend of mine from Chicago bought a ranch that borders the Muchmore Hole. It's very hard to get to. And he lets me fish it. So he and I were down there one day, and I was kind of almost practice casting and tied into this enormous rainbow trout. Which had a head like a salmon. People don't believe it, but I've got a picture.
Incredible.
And it's the biggest rainbow trout I have ever seen on the Blackfoot. I have caught bigger fish on the Blackfoot, bull trout, and in that hole. But this fish was about 27, close to 28 inches, somewhere in there. And as I say, he had this enormous head on it. And I nearly lost him several times. We couldn't get him in the net. He was too big to get in a landing net. And my partner, the owner of the ranch, was trying to get him in and couldn't do it. I said, what the hell are you doing? You know, you're beating that fish to death. He's going to get on. He said, no, John. He said, he's too big. I can't get him in here. And we finally wore the fish out and landed him, took his picture and got him back. And he was in good shape.
So good.
Good, solid catch and release.
Awesome.
When he left in a boom flurry. And I went over and sat on a log and thought, you know, I've been looking for this all my life. You know, I'm not young. This has been a quest of decades and decades and decades. And I just thought that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Later, my friend asked me, he said, would you write this story for my anglers group in Chicago? So I wrote a little squib for them. And somebody read that and said, you know, you ought to write a story about this. Why don't you try it for Big Sky magazine?
Hmm.
and they'll pay you. Oh, well, yes. I mean, that's how I make a living. And so I did. And 2 years after that, another fine editor was in Montana on vacation, picked up an old tattered copy of Big Sky magazine. There was a story, and he called me up and he said, how would you like to write a book on this? I said, well, frankly, I wouldn't. He said, I've gone on in my firewriting career, spending a lot of time establishing a separate identity from my father. And I've done that successfully. And people know what I do, and it's different from what my dad did, and it's good. Here I am going to write about fly fishing on the Blackfoot River, which is couldn't be closer as you talk about parallel universes. And I started to think about it and talked to the editor, Peter Hubbard, and saw the things that I could bring into that story that I really wanted to write about. And I started writing it, and it felt wonderful. For one thing, I have been writing about fatal wildland fires for 25 years, and deserving, fine young people being burned to death, and talking about this with their parents afterward, and spending time with their friends, and thinking about it. And I had the beginning, I called it the well of sadness.
Yeah, it's heavy.
I mean, it was heavy. And here all of a sudden was something that was loving and wonderful to write about and a success story. And so that's how the book got done. And I kept pulling more things into it. People say, oh, an awful lot of different stuff in here. Yeah, there are. But it's all the same river. It's all the same family. It's all the same place. And if that book has one great merit, it establishes a real sense of place and gives
Yeah,
you a lot of background.
it does. And it's a phenomenal book. I actually have that right here in front of me. So I reread A River Runs Through It last week. And then over the last 2 days, reread this. I finished it yesterday or last 3 days and reread it again. Very much enjoyed it. And it is. It is more than a hodgepodge. There are connecting points there. And it's a wonderful book. And for those that are looking for something to read or wanting to just go buy it. It's a Home Waters, John McClane, and with the lowercase L. We don't want to confuse him with the Lowlander Scottish McClanes, as his grandfather was quick to say. But it's a wonderful book. You want to check it out for sure. So in this book, you do have a chapter called Paul, which was something your father would say, and you talk about this in the book. And one of the things that, as we kind of transition to talk a little bit about your father's work that has seemed to carry on in your work, and it's here in Home Waters, is this love of family. And we live in this interesting time where it seems like everybody is against one another, everybody is fighting one another, and just reading about familial love and a love for a place is a refreshing thing to take in. I thoroughly enjoyed it because of that factor. What is this piece, though? Your dad so loved his brother, so loved his father and family. What do you think can be learned from your father's work as you pick up A River Runs Through It and other stories and your work as well about the importance of family love?
Let's start with something very specific, which is families where a sibling has gone astray and been lost. Being my father's son, I am often the recipient of feelings expressed by people about his work. They don't have anybody, I'm the closest thing they can get to him. So they tell me about it. As recently as yesterday, I got another one of these things. It's a very common pattern. Somebody who So, brother or sister was a black sheep of some kind. Various degrees of personal responsibility for that, but it broke the relationship, and the sadness lingers on forever. And these people think that they're alone until they read A River Runs Through It, and then suddenly they discover that they are not alone, that there is someone who has not only sympathy for this, but actually went through it themselves. And raised it to a high literary level, which has healing qualities. And they are struck by this. And they tell me this sometimes with tears in their eyes. And I'm always glad to receive that information and to tell them, you are not alone. There are many people who are in this position, who loved and lost, who gave the best of themselves, offered their love, their empathy, their understanding, their support, and had it thrown back in their faces in one way or another. And I've had to live with that ever since. So I think that that has been, I know that that has been an enduring quality of that book, that it has provided a healing to a degree for these people, and that that's terribly important. The whole idea of a family unit is, you know, people think it's passe. It's not. I mean, that's where it all begins. And when you break that apart, you start looking at a cultural landscape like the one we are looking at right now. And something really bad has happened. We are in very deep trouble. And I think part of the reason is that this sense of people loving and supporting each other as family has been dissed, has broken down. It is not supported in the way that it should be.
Yeah, and I think any society rises or falls based on the health of families, what our nations, what our peoples, other than collections of families. And when you see families struggling, when you see that disintegration there, then what ends up happening is what you have is fissures and splinters within nature's cultures and all of the things that go with that. What one of the things that struck me as I was reading your work, reflecting on your father and grandfather, at one point your grandfather said to your dad, "Do you think we could have, you think I could have helped him," or something to that degree? And it seems like in the midst of that tragedy and love is that the questions always remain, you know, some of the questions of could things have been different with that sibling or with that son or daughter that was that, that black sheep son or daughter. And then, you know, you grieve, but eventually you survive, you make it. And those questions seem to still linger. And it's weird to have both comfort in one hand of things can't be changed, things can't be undone, and then reading a river runs through it, and then bubbling to the surface are people that you know that are similar to Paul, and yet loving them so much that you want to help and not being able to. And so there's just so many pieces that are personal for so many. And I can imagine, just like that conversation you had yesterday, those conversations are going to continue to come just because it is so personal. For people.
And common. I mean, this is a common experience. This is not a one-off. It isn't, Paul was a particular person and this kind of thing doesn't happen. I'm sorry.
It
happens and has happened and will happen again.
Yes.
Despite our best efforts.
Yeah,
and that's
right.
The haunting part of it. You know, did you do too much?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you not do enough? And all this lingering doubt and self-recrimination.
Yeah. And well, that leads us, we have about 10 minutes or so in our time. And I do want to bring things to a question that I posed to you at the end. And then we're going to hopefully talk a few minutes about fly fishing. So I love Scottish Presbyterians. One of my favorite authors, theologians, is a gentleman named George Smeaton. And he wrote a lot on the doctrine of the Holy Spirit and the atonement. Your father grew up in a home, and Paul as well, where they learned the Westminster Shorter Catechism and spent time learning those things from their Presbyterian heritage and background. So your grandfather did raise them that way. I am curious, because at one point in your book, you'd said that your father did cast off what you'd said was the reverend's, his father's Victorian Christianity. So I was curious, did you ever have conversations with your dad about conversations with his father about faith and about Presbyterianism, or how those things developed as your father kind of transitioned? Or was that after your father or your grandfather had passed away? I'm just curious if they had those conversations and if those relayed to you at all.
We didn't talk a lot about it. And I think that was very deliberate on his part, because I had to face my father's spiritual evolution in a written document. coming out as a foreword to a book this summer. And it's a very difficult spiritual life. When he was in Montana, a young man, he was a dutiful son of a Presbyterian minister who took things very literally, but who also had a very fine mind and was no fool. And he did have conversations. They did have conversations between the two of them. My dad went away to the East to college, Dartmouth, and he spent 6 years there. He taught there for 2 years after he had gotten his degree. And it's a long way from Hanover, New Hampshire to Montana, especially when you're the son of a Presbyterian minister who doesn't make much money. And so he didn't go home very often. And he began to break away at that point from those Victorian Christianity.
Yeah.
He then went to work at the University of Chicago, which is was at the time an extraordinary place, full of scientific advancement, literary advancement, educational advancement. And he attended church once in a while, but mm-hmm. he never pushed it on my sister or on me. The closest they got to doing that was one time took us to a, that I recall, the only time I recall, took us to church. Must have been on Easter because the church was blanketed with flowers.
Yeah.
Okay. And said, you know, this is their big day. And if you want to, you can continue with this. And I looked at it and I said, no, this isn't what spiritual life is to me. Spiritual life is the mountains, and the rivers, and Sealy Lake, and the woods. And so I didn't. And I was never gotten pushed into it. I asked him later. Later, I sang in an Episcopal choir for 8 years or so. I went to an Episcopal school, and I am an Episcopal. So it isn't like, you know, I was lost to, you know, forever. But we never had deep, abiding conversations about that kind of thing. He mm-hmm. was very unhappy that I became an Episcopalian.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, you joined the English church.
Mm-hmm.
But it was on tribal grounds.
Mm-hmm.
So he had really three stages of his spiritual life. One, the dutiful son. Secondly, the breaking away and becoming a secularist. And finally, anybody who's read A River Runs Through It knows that this man had a deep spiritual life.
Right.
It was not something that you can categorize all that well. He would not have been able to recite the Nicene or the Apostles' Creeds with any conviction. But to deny him an ardent connection to the eternal, to God, is just simply wrong. One of his great friends and of mine, Father Peter Powell, Episcopal priest, living to this day in his 90s, great man, said that he had never read a document outside the Gospels that was more Christian than A River Runs Through It.
Hmm.
And it was a kind of an inarticulate Christianity or religiosity. But so what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes the most powerful form of religious communication doesn't have a lot of words. Music.
Yeah.
Art.
Mm-hmm.
Prayer. Sometimes it's silent. And he, when he got to write about his brother and the things that were deepest in him, he suddenly couldn't be this easy secularist.
Mm-hmm.
He had to deliver the real stuff.
Yeah.
And he did. And it's there. It's just not in the terms of conventional religiosity.
Yeah. He did walk that line of wilderness and academy. And it seemed that he did want to bridge that gap, and he did a fine job of doing that. And I read the book, and even though, you know, With the River Runs Through It, there seems to be a deep and abiding respect of the faith of his father, even without the embracing of everything that his father embraced. He clearly respected his father, and that came out a lot in the book. And that's one of the things that I really appreciate about your family, is there is this connection to family legacy, even though there is a uniqueness to you compared to your father, a uniqueness of your father compared to your grandfather. There are these ties that bind you together that seem, you know, wonderful, and that I would hope to replicate in some way with my children and Lord willing, one day, grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, anybody who thinks that this is easy is wrong, and that it is certain of success is wrong. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of failures along the way. There's all kinds of bad feeling along the way. But what are you really trying to do? Are you really trying to hold this together? Are you really committed to it? Are you willing to forgive and move on? And is that the biggest thing? or is the biggest thing listing all your complaints and belly aching? And I think that, you know, we've gotten to a point now where the latter is what's emphasized.
Yeah.
No, the formula for doing this, insofar as there's a formula, is well within traditional Christianity. I mean, it's just a turn again. You know, don't be satisfied with having betrayed. Turn again. Turn again. It works.
Yeah. Well, let's give the last word to fly fishing. Let's have fun. I'm going to give you one last question, and you just hit this out of the park. We've been enjoying fly fishing. Me and my boys, my oldest boy has just started. Why should people get into fly fishing? And what is so wonderful about it for children, fathers, and even grandfathers?
Well, it's a lifetime sport, and it will always challenge you. And there are different challenges along the way. When you start out, especially this position you're in now, fishing with your kids, every family should try to find something where they do it together. And what better thing to do together than to get in the outdoors, get into a river, you're all both in the same water, the water that passes by your legs then goes around the legs of your sons. There's a commonality to it. And so on. But if you can start out with a stick, a paper clip, and a worm, and then wind up tying gorgeous dry flies and getting into all the bamboo elite stuff if you want to.
Yeah.
It can soak up all your money. That's a good place to put money.
Right.
How many rods do you really need?
But
as I said, I'm working on a story on the rewards of fly fishing later in life, and there are enormous ones. One thing, you slow down and you take take more from the minute, I think, than you do when you're just banging away. I got to get to the next hole. I've got to get a bigger fish. How many did I catch today? None of that matters as much when you're older. What matters is maybe one fish during a fishing period, one nice one. And you think about these things. And there are ways to approach it, or ways to approach fishing when you're older that work. Mm-hmm. I can still bank fish the Blackfoot River in some places because I know enough about it. I know where the boats have to be at a certain hour so that they're cleared off or they haven't arrived yet, and where there's enough bank fishing or up to your knees and no farther fishing, that I can do it and do it alone, and I do. And it's very satisfying. But it is not as extensive as when I was younger. And I was doing this last fall and thinking, you know, I only fished about a third of the water that I used to, but I'm pretty happy. It's been a beautiful day and so on. And my friends all have stories like this. One friend said, at the age of 77, he did a lifetime check, and he bought his own drift boat on the Missouri River. I've fished with him in this drift boat, very nice boat, but he hadn't done that. Now he needs it. You have to have that boat to fish the Missouri, and now he's doing that. So you get to the total end of life. Wonderful story. Guy was really old. And he was still fishing, and he went out one day and he didn't come back. And his friend went out to find him, and there he was, lying expired on the bank with his rod right next to him. And his friend picked up the rod and landed a great big brown.
Hmm.
Now, you know, we all die, as in Adam. How do you want to go? That's not a bad way to go.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it isn't. Well, that's wonderful stories, and I think a good encouragement for people to consider taking up fly fishing. We're going in a couple weeks to fish some Missouri rivers. I take a men's group with fathers and sons, and we do a two-day float trip on the Jacks Fork River in Eminence, Missouri. And there is several tributaries, rivers, small rivers, mountain rivers through there, Ozark rivers, and we're going to spend some time fishing. And then next year, our plan is actually to go into Yellowstone, and we're going to go up into Bozeman, and we're going to take our little camper and head out there and fish. So we're going to have some good times fishing on some bigger waters than where we're going to be here. But I'm so enjoying this process of getting into fly fishing. I want to thank you so much for this conversation today. And for my listeners, And viewers, I want you to check out these books. This is John McClain's book, Home Waters, phenomenal book. This is Fire on the Mountain. I just also ordered, I've got in my Amazon box that's coming in the mail right now, another book by John, and then John's father's works. The most famous is A River Runs Through It, and then Young Men in Fire, which is another phenomenal work. John, thank you so much for this conversation. It's been a lot of fun.
I enjoyed it, Jared. Thank you.
Thank you. We've been listening and talking to John McClain. Thank you guys so much. I hope you guys have a great rest of your day. Thanks again for listening to the Shepherd's Crook podcast. For more information, you can go to theshepherdscrook.co. Please consider leaving a rating or review on iTunes. And if you want to become a member of the Shepherd's Crook, please message me and we'll get you on the list. We hope you have a great rest of your day.